Mark 13, and we'll begin in verse 14. But when you see the abomination of desolation standing where he ought not be, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let the one who is on the housetop not go down, nor enter his house, to take anything out. And let the one who is in the field not turn back to take his cloak. And alas, for women who are pregnant and for those who are nursing infants in those days, pray that it may not happen in winter, for in those days there will be such tribulation as has not been from the beginning of the creation that God created until now and never will be. And if the Lord did not cut short the days, no human being would be saved. But for the sake of the elect whom he chose, he shortened the days. And then if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or look, there he is, do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and perform signs and wonders to lead astray, if possible, the elect. But be on your guard, I have told you all things beforehand. Verse 24. But in those days, after that tribulation, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will be falling from heaven, and the powers in the heavens will be shaken. And then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. And then he will send out the angels and gather his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven. And you can be seated. All right, I'm just going to warn you guys this morning, it's going to feel a lot like a Bible study and less like a sermon this morning, okay? So buckle up. We're continuing our look at the Olivet Discourse. That's what this section is called. This is Jesus' teaching about the destruction of Jerusalem. And sort of like if you're climbing a mountain, the closer you get to the end point, the harder it gets, the steeper it gets, the more difficult it is. And that's really where we're at here as well. And really, no matter your position, how you take Mark 13, or it's also in Luke 21 and Matthew 24, no matter your position, this section is hard. And that's okay. Our task as Bible-believing Christians is to understand what the Bible said. God gave us a book with verbs and adjectives and nouns and relative clauses and genre and that sort of thing. He didn't give us a picture book. He didn't give us, like, interpretive dance to pass on the truths of predestination and young earth creation. We have a book with words. God wrote these words down, and sometimes they're hard for us to understand. I think we can all sort of admit that. And it does take a lot of work to understand it rightly. Now, I think most of you guys are familiar with my view on this particular passage, that I believe this whole passage, all of Mark 13, is talking about the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Some people think it's also talking about the second coming or the rapture, but I believe this is just completely focused on the fall of Jerusalem in the first century. I believe that primarily because of the context of what Jesus told his disciples. He's answering their question. And because he says in verse 30 that all these things will take place in this generation. So that's the context, and those are the cues. Now, my view is often called a partial preterist view. That's the name of the view that I hold to. Preter is Latin, which means to go before. Or in the past. And so the idea is that these passages are talking about things that have already happened. Their future from Jesus' point of view, from when he's telling them, but from our perspective, these are in the past. Now, there is a view called the full preterist view. And just to put it bluntly, that is damnable heresy. And the full preterist view says that not only did Jesus come in judgment on Jerusalem, but that was his second coming, and that was the resurrection. That there is no future resurrection, there is no future coming of Jesus, and we deny that explicitly. In fact, Paul warns us in 2 Timothy 2:17 and 18 that is grave error and can shipwreck the faith. So. Full preterism is not orthodoxy. That is not what I'm teaching. I'm teaching that this section in Mark 13 is focused on 70 AD. And actually, I think, really, to be honest, any eschatology, if you're premillennial, if you're amillennial, if you're postmillennial, whatever, you could still defend your position. I think you could still defend your position from other passages of Scripture and still hold a partial preterist view of the Olivet Discourse. I don't think there's anything in the Olivet Discourse that is necessary for any particular eschatological passage. One other thing that I'm going to mention is that if We've covered a lot of ground in Mark 13. If you missed a sermon, or I know there's a couple people who are visiting this morning, if you want to know kind of where we're at, you probably do well to do some catch up. You can listen to the sermons or read them online. This morning section is particularly tough, but I will say I think it makes sense if we understand that verses 24 through 27 are all quotes from other places in the Bible. They're all quotes from other places in the Bible, and Jesus just quotes them in rapid fashion. He doesn't explain the meaning to us. He assumes that his disciples will understand it, and he assumes that the readers of the gospel will understand what he's referring to as well. And up on the screen has kind of been our general outline of Mark 13. So far, we're kind of toward the bottom there. But that's what Jesus is doing now. He's now talking about the coming of the Son of Man. And so he quotes all of these different references from the Old Testament, and he doesn't explain it at all. It's like when we quote movie lines to our friends. You guys do that? You quote movies lines or a line from a song or something like that, and you expect them to know what you're talking about. And it's really awkward if they don't. Or if they quote a movie line, you're like, what does that have to do with what we're talking about right now? And they're like, it's from a movie, man. And you're like, I didn't get that at all. That's what Jesus is doing. He's quoting from the Old Testament these fantastical sections. And if we don't understand them, then I don't think we're going to understand what Jesus is talking about. We might actually think when Jesus says that the sun will be darkened, the moon won't give its light, and the stars will be falling from heaven, you might actually think that what he's describing is something that we could go outside and we could see happening. We could have a telescope or some binoculars, and we could see these cosmic phenomenon going on. Or maybe when the angels go out and they gather the people, maybe that's the physical gathering of people like in a pre-tribulation rapture sort of eschatology. But my contention this morning is they're not. My contention is they're not. If we just look up these passages, I think we can get an idea of what Jesus is saying and get the plain sense in which he is trying to help us understand. So here's my contention this morning. Okay, you can just jot this down. I don't think I put them at the notes. But verses 24 and 25, when Jerusalem is destroyed, spiritual and political realities will change forever. When Jerusalem is destroyed, spiritual and political realities will change forever. Verse 26, when Jerusalem is destroyed, that will confirm that Jesus is reigning in heaven. And then verse 27, when Jerusalem is destroyed, the gospel will go out to all the globe. So that's my basic thesis. Okay, let's go. Verse 24, but in those days, after that tribulation, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light and the stars will be falling from heaven and the powers in the heavens will be shaken. So Jesus says, after that tribulation, what tribulation are we talking about? Well, we're talking about the tribulation that he was just mentioning, which again, I contended is the horrifying destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. That's the immediate context. Is the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. That's the whole context of the chapter. And he says that is going to happen in that generation. And so after that tribulation, after Jerusalem is destroyed, there's this phenomenon with the sun, the moon, and the stars. Now, if you've read really almost any eschatology book from a dispensational perspective or heard a dispensational pastor preach this passage, they would say that these are literal phenomena. In fact, if you look at John MacArthur's, and I love John MacArthur, you guys know that, but he's just on record with all this stuff. So if you look at John MacArthur's study Bible, he will say that these are the cosmic bodies and they're careening through space when Jesus comes back. This is the classical dispensational view that when Jesus returns, either at the rapture or at his second coming, that the sun will actually be darkened, the moon will turn red, and there will be some sort of phenomenon with the stars. When I say dispensational, by the way, what I mean is usually those who hold to like a pre-tribulational or a mid-tribulational end times position. So there's a rapture, there's some like a 7-year tribulation, there's the second coming, a millennium, and then the new heavens and the new earth. And if that's what you hold, that's fine. That's fine. But it's usually from that perspective that people understand these events and they would say literally. And that's part of what dispensationalism does. It's a mode of interpretation that seeks to interpret the Bible very, very literally, which sounds good, except if you don't interpret the Bible according to how it's presenting the material, you can get really confused. Okay? Now, if you remember when I started this series, I gave you guys some homework. Do you remember that? Uh-oh. I'm not even asked for raised hands for who did the homework. The homework was to go and look up when the Bible uses sun, moon, and stars. These kind of phrases. Okay. And again, my contention is it just means big changes. That's really all it means. We might say that the world is turned upside down, or a turning point in history, or something like that. The phrases aren't literal, they're just sayings. And when these phrases with sun, moon, and stars are used in the Bible, that's the idea. The world is just turned upside down. God brings judgment, and he just flips everything on its head. And I want to show you this in several spots. So turn back to Isaiah 13. Isaiah 13. And you can look at the chapter heading. I think for most of us, it says something about the judgment of Babylon. This is the judgment about the downfall of Babylon. And if you don't know Bible history very well, you need to understand Babylon was the biggest superpower you can imagine in ancient times. It was like if the U.S. and Russia and China somehow all banded together and they had all the political and military might and political power, that's who Babylon was. So it was like the superpower of all superpowers of its day. And God says, my judgment's coming for you, and I am going to tear you apart because of your sin. So take a look, Isaiah 13, verses 9 through 16. Behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel, with wrath and fierce anger, to make the land a desolation and to destroy its sinners from it. Verse 10, for the stars of the heavens and their constellations will not give light. The sun will be dark at its rising, and the moon will not shed its light. I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity. I will put an end to the pomp of the arrogant and lay low the pompous pride of the ruthless. I will make people more rare than fine gold and mankind than the gold of Ophir. Verse 13, therefore I will make the heavens tremble and the earth will be shaken out of its place at the wrath of the Lord of hosts in the day of his fierce anger. And like a hunted gazelle or like a sheep with none to gather them, each will turn to his own people and each will flee to his own land. Whoever is found will be thrust through and whoever is caught will fall by the sword. Their infants will be dashed in pieces before their eyes. Their houses will be plundered and their wives ravished. Wow. That is the judgment that God is bringing on Babylon. He's not talking about the second coming at all. Not at all. And the cosmic descriptions that are used here aren't literal. The earth wasn't shaken out of its orbit, you guys. And we have no record at all that there was any anything going on with the moon or the stars or any sort of eclipse or anything. This is just God's way of saying, I am bringing massive political upheaval and massive judgment on the world. And the reason for the massive political judgment is because of spiritual idolatry. So this judgment of God comes because of idolatry, because of sinfulness, and what God does is obliterates a nation. That's what he does. He does that with Babylon. And that's really what we see in Jesus' day too, isn't it? In Mark 12, we saw that Jesus just lambasted the Pharisees and the scribes and the chief priests and all of them for their wickedness and their evil. And then what's he telling the disciples is going to happen just the very next chapter? I'm just going to completely upend the whole thing. I'm going to destroy them. Now, I want you to slowly turn like page by page to Isaiah 24. And I just want you to notice the chapter headings. Most of you guys have some similar chapter headings. So chapter 15 is an oracle concerning Moab. Moab is getting judged. It's to the east of Israel. Chapter 17 is an oracle concerning Damascus. 18 concerning Cush. That would have been like Ethiopia and Africa. So this whole section of Isaiah over and over again is just this, the judgment over and over on the people. And so by the time you get to Isaiah 24, we have the judgment on the whole world. And God is going to use cosmic language again to describe his judgment on the whole world. So take a look, Isaiah 24, verses 3 through 7. God says, "The earth shall be utterly empty and utterly plundered, for the Lord has spoken this word. The earth mourns and withers. The world languishes and withers. The highest people of the earth languish. The earth lies defiled under its inhabitants, for they have transgressed the laws, violated the statutes, broken the everlasting covenant. Therefore, a curse devours the earth, and its inhabitants suffer for their guilt. Therefore, the inhabitants of the earth are scorched, and few men are left. The wine mourns, the vine languishes, all the merry-hearted sigh." So there's judgment coming, and even like the vines can feel the judgment of God. Look down at verse 17. "Terror and the pit and the snare are upon you, O inhabitant of the earth. He who flees at the sound of terror shall fall into the pit, and he who climbs out of the pit shall be caught in the snare. For the windows of heaven are opened, and the foundations of the earth tremble. The earth is utterly broken. The earth is split apart. The earth is violently shaken. The earth staggers like a drunken man. It sways like a hut. Its transgression lies heavy upon it, and it falls, and it will not rise again. On that day, Yahweh will punish the host of heaven in heaven and the kings of the earth on the earth. They will be gathered together as prisoners in a pit. They will be shut up in a prison, and after many days they will be punished. Then the moon will be confounded and the sun ashamed, and the Lord of hosts, for the Lord of hosts reigns on Mount Zion and in Jerusalem, and his glory will be before the elders." You guys, the world had become so wicked that God's just like, "I'm judging all of y'all. I'm just taking everyone out." It really had become like the days of Noah, when God just drowned the entire world. And again, you see that he uses cosmic language to describe the judgment. The moon is confounded or dismayed. That's weird, you guys. The moon is confused. And the sun is ashamed. How does a ball of nuclear explosion have shame? It doesn't. It's just language. It's just God turning the world upside down. That's what we would use. Turn over to Ezekiel 32. Just a couple of books to the right. Ezekiel 32. Here God is judging Egypt and Pharaoh. One of the things that I want you to notice in these passages is that the judgment is brutal and graphic in nature. I mean, when God uses cosmic language, he is pulling together all of his wrath, all of his fury, and he is exploding it on that country in the most graphic way as a judgment on their sin. God is not playing. When you see sun, moon, and stars, you know God's fed up. God is no longer patient anymore. He's bringing all the wrath. He's bringing all the judgment. The children die by sword and the women are ravished. And that's why Jesus uses, I think he uses sun, moon, and stars language. Because He's saying, you guys, you have no idea what is about to come on this city. It is going to be unimaginable judgment, and that's what happens. So here, this is what's going to happen to Pharaoh and Egypt. So Ezekiel 32, verses 1 through 10. "In the 12th year of the 12th month, on the first day of the month, the word of Yahweh came to me, 'Son of man, raise a lamentation over Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and say to him, You consider yourself a lion of the nations, but you are like a dragon in the seas. You burst forth in your rivers, trouble the waters with your feet, and foul their rivers. Thus says Yahweh God, I will throw my net over you with a host of many peoples, and they will haul you up in my dragnet, and I will cast you on the ground. On the open field I will fling you, and I will cause all the birds of the heavens to settle on you, and I will gorge the beasts of the whole earth with you. I will strew your flesh upon the mountains and fill the valleys with your carcass. I will drench the land even to the mountains with your flowing blood, and the ravines will be full of you. When I blot you out, I will cover the heavens and I will make their stars dark. I will cover the sun with a cloud, and the moon shall not give its light. all the bright lights of heaven, and will I make dark over you and put darkness on your land, declares Yahweh God. Verse 9, I will trouble the hearts of many peoples when I bring your destruction among the nations into the countries that you have not known. I will make many peoples appalled at you, and the hair of their kings shall bristle with horror because of you when I brandish my sword before them. They shall tremble every moment, everyone for his own life, on the day of your downfall. This is severe, gruesome, overwhelming, complete judgment of Egypt. Again, he uses the cosmic language to show how severe the judgment is. Turn over to Joel 2. A couple more pages to the right. Hosea, and then Joel. Joel chapter 2. This is interesting because this is where God is actually talking about the downfall of Jerusalem. Probably not in 70 AD, but probably earlier. 597. And again, it's the same judgment language. So Joel 2, beginning in verse 6. Before them, peoples are in anguish. All faces grow pale. Like warriors, they charge. Like soldiers, they scale the wall. Talking about the people coming into Jerusalem. They march, each on his way. They do not swerve from their paths. They do not jostle one another. Each marches in his path. They burst through the weapons and are not halted. They leap upon the city. They run upon the walls. They climb up into the houses. They enter through the windows like a thief. The earth quakes before them. The heavens tremble. The sun and the moon are darkened, and the stars withdraw their shining. The Lord utters his voice before his army, for his camp is exceedingly great. He who executes his word is powerful, for the day of Yahweh is great and very awesome. Who can endure it? This is interesting. Where is Yahweh's army? Yahweh's army is actually on the outside attacking Jerusalem. That's Yahweh's army. And again, cosmic language. Cosmic language. Amos chapter 8, verse 9, you don't need to turn there, but it says the same thing. And on that day, declares Yahweh God, I will make the sun go down at noon and darken the earth in broad daylight. You guys, just to put it very clearly, as clear as I can, there's never been any evidence that these cosmic signs were actually ever visible. This is just God's language for I'm bringing judgment on a people and on a nation. That's really just how he uses it. It's a figure of speech. Now turn over to one more, Acts 2. Acts 2, this is the day of Pentecost. And if you remember, on the day of Pentecost, the Holy Spirit is poured out on the 120 believers or so, and they spoke in languages. They spoke in tongues. And the gobs of people who are visiting Jerusalem, they hear these believers, and they hear them speaking in their own language. Okay? And so how does Peter explain this phenomenon? What's going on? Well, he actually quotes the prophet Joel that we just read. It's interesting. Verse 17. Actually, let's go back up to verse 16 in Acts chapter 2. But this is what was uttered through the prophet Joel. And in the last days it shall be, God declares, that I will pour out my spirit on all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, and your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams, even on my male servants and female servants. In those days I will pour out my spirit, and they shall prophesy. And I will show wonders in the heavens above and signs on the earth below, blood and fire and vapor and smoke. The sun shall be turned to darkness and the moon to blood before the day of the Lord comes, the great and magnificent day. And it shall come to pass that everyone who calls upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. Peter says, Joel said this would happen, you guys. And you go, wait, what would happen? That what would happen? Was there an eclipse that day? No. What happened that day is that the Holy Spirit was poured out on believers. And this was actually a judgment on unbelieving Israel to show that God had now turned to the nations. This is the very beginning of God's pouring out his grace, not his wrath, but his grace on the nations through faith in Jesus Christ. And it was so massive. This shift in salvation history is so massive that the only thing biblically that it can be compared to is the sun, moon, and stars changing. Like when Babylon fell or Jerusalem fell or God destroyed Egypt. This is the magnitude of the shift that has happened in biblical history when God pours out his spirit on his people. By the way, this same language is used in Revelation 6:2, or actually I think it's 6:12 and 8:12. And again, it's not literal. It's the same idea. So, sun, moon, and stars. It's not literal. Jesus is just saying, this is the judgment that's going to be poured out, and the world's going to change. Now, while we're here, because it's going to relate to the next point, I want you to look down in Acts 2, verses 30 through 36. And we're just going to tuck this away, okay? Verse 30, Peter goes on in his sermon. He says, being therefore a prophet, and knowing that God had sworn with an oath to him, to David, that he would set one of his descendants on his throne, he foresaw and spoke about the resurrection of the Christ, that he was not abandoned to Hades, nor did his flesh see corruption. This Jesus God raised up, and of that we are all witnesses, being therefore exalted to the right hand of God, and having received from the Father the promise of the Holy Spirit, he has poured out this that you yourselves are seeing and hearing. And he goes on. Here's what Peter is saying. He says, remember when God promised to David that he would set one of his descendants on his throne forever? Remember that promise? It's 2 Samuel 7. God fulfilled that promise when he raised Jesus from the dead, and when Jesus was exalted into heaven and is now sitting at the right hand of God. Jesus is reigning on David's throne right now in glory and in power. Okay? That's what Peter is saying here. So tuck that away. Okay, back to Mark 13. So, verses 24 and 25. But in those days, after that tribulation, again, 70 AD, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will be falling from heaven, and the powers in the heavens will be shaken. So what is Jesus actually saying? He's saying that there's going to be a massive political upheaval, a massive shift in how God is working because of God's judgment on Israel. And worship of Yahweh is no longer centered on a place or a physical building. God dwells where? In his people. That's where God dwells now. The point, you guys, is not to look up in the sky for signs. You know all those books about the blood moons and, you know, all that stuff? Let me just save you a lot of time. Don't read them. Don't read them. I'm telling you, you can just light your campfire with those because they have nothing to do with the Bible. The point is that Jerusalem would be destroyed. And it would be a massive shift in what God was doing. Okay? Jerusalem is destroyed. The earth is turned upside down. And by the way, physical Jerusalem, until the new heavens and new earth, will never be the place where the people of God need to gather for anything special. You can go to Jerusalem. It's amazing. It's really cool. I highly recommend it. But it's not needful for us because there's nothing intrinsically special about that place anymore. God dwells in his people. And that's more amazing and more fantastic than anything he did in the Old Covenant. Okay, point number two. Buckle up. When Jerusalem is destroyed, that will confirm that Jesus is reigning as the Son of God in heaven. Okay, now look at the verse. We're going to have to connect some dots here, all right? Verse 26. And then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. Jason, how do you get that application out of this verse? And what I'm going to tell you is this is the hardest verse in the whole chapter. And by the way, I think this paragraph is the hardest paragraph in the whole chapter for anybody, okay? But just to state it plainly, I do not believe that this is talking about Jesus' second coming at all. I believe this is actually talking about Jesus' ascension into heaven. And I believe what Jesus is saying is that when Jerusalem is destroyed, that will be a sign confirming that he ascended into heaven and is reigning on the throne of God in glory. Okay? And I'm going to connect those dots to you, but let me just say that again. Okay? I believe that what Jesus is saying is that when Jerusalem is destroyed, that will be a sign confirming that he is actually seated on the throne in heaven, reigning in glory. Jesus is coming, but he's not coming from heaven to earth. He's coming from earth to heaven. That's where he's going. And that happened, like Peter said, at the ascension when he was exalted. Now, remember I said this whole paragraph is just quotes from the Old Testament. Remember that? Okay, so go to Daniel 7. Daniel chapter 7. So in Daniel 7, we have a vision of one like the Son of Man. This is a vision of Jesus coming to the Father in heaven to receive a kingdom. And remember in Acts 2, we read that David didn't ascend to the Father and receive a kingdom. Jesus ascended to the Father and received a kingdom. And he sits at the right hand of God. So take a look, Daniel 7, verses 9 through 12. We'll set it up here. Daniel says, as I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. So this is a heavenly vision. Daniel is getting a glimpse of heaven. His clothing is white as snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames. Its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him. A thousand thousand served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. I looked then because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking. And as I looked, the beast was killed, and its body destroyed and given over to be burned with fire. As for the rest of the beast, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. All right, so what's happening here? Daniel has this vision of heaven. He sees God. He's the Ancient of Days, and he's surrounded by just millions and billions of angels and of the saints in heaven. He is there in heaven in full power and full glory. He is the center of all things. He's the judge. The books are opened. The idea is that he is judging those who are around him. And so he sits in judgment. And what about these beasts in verses 11 through 12? Well, I think these are the various rulers that Daniel has already talked about throughout his book. I don't think their identity is actually all that important, but what is important is that the most dangerous of them have been destroyed by God, while some still have authority for a time. And what I think that is that Satan is still using people throughout this age for his purposes. But watch what happens next. This is what Jesus is quoting. This is what Mark is quoting. So he's sitting there in heaven, has this vision, and he says, I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a Son of Man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. Who's this talking about, you guys? It's talking about Jesus. Jesus going into heaven, on the clouds of heaven, to receive glory and honor and power in a kingdom that will not be destroyed. And all the nations will worship him. He came on clouds into heaven in glory to receive a kingdom. And again, when did that happen? That happened at his ascension. Listen to Acts chapter 1, verse 9. And when he had said these things, as they were looking on, he was lifted up, and a cloud took him out of sight. That's what he records. Where did Jesus go? He went to heaven. He went to heaven on a cloud. Now stay with me. When Jesus is talking about the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory, he's not talking about coming from heaven to earth. He's talking about going from earth to heaven to reign until his coming. This is the only other reference in the Bible to the Son of Man coming on clouds in power and glory. He's not coming to earth. He's coming to the Father. You say, well, that's kind of a weird use of language. Well, imagine I called up my parents who live in the Tri-Cities. And I said, hey, guys, can I come down for the weekend? Yeah, sure, that's fine. So I go down there. Which direction am I heading? I'm heading south. and I'm packing up, coming back home, and I text my wife, "Hey, honey, I'm coming home. Now which direction am I going?" "I'm going north." Okay? I'm coming one way or another. It's all referential language. That's the issue. So when Jesus is talking about the coming in Mark 13 on the Olivet Discourse, our question should be, which way? Which direction? And what Daniel lays out for us is the direction is to heaven, to the Ancient of Days, seated on his throne. He makes it clear the direction of his coming. Now, there will be a day where Jesus comes again from heaven to earth, but the New Testament authors actually often use a different word from that. It's called epiphaneia. It's his appearing. It's a sudden appearance is the idea. So, but that's not what he's talking about here. Okay, so I think the coming of Jesus on the clouds is him coming into heaven. Now, you should be asking a big question right now. In Mark 13, Jason, Jesus says, "You will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds." It's a visual thing. We didn't see that. How do we get around that? It means it has to be the second coming. Not so fast. Matthew 24. Turn over to Matthew 24. Matthew 24. This is Matthew's version. I'm going to show you two passages in Matthew that I think will help. In Matthew's version, what Jesus says is not that they will see the coming. What Jesus says is that they will see a sign. A sign of the coming. This is really important. Okay? And as a result of the sign, people will instinctively realize, oh no, Jesus is in fact reigning in heaven. Just like he said. So take a look, Matthew 24, verses 29 through 31. It's a parallel passage. "Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man. And then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory, and he will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call," and he goes on. So it's the same context as Mark. Matthew just adds the crucial tidbit that they see a sign. They don't see the cosmic things. They see the sign that points to the cosmic things. And so he's bringing in that language from the previous verse. And we could say, then will appear the sign that the Son of Man is in heaven. That's really the idea. So put this all together, okay? When Jerusalem is destroyed like Babylon, like Egypt, like Damascus, and even Jerusalem in the past, when the sun, moon, and stars all proverbially died, it will be a sign that Jesus is reigning in heaven right now. That will be the sign that Jesus is reigning. How do we know that Jesus is reigning right now? Because Jerusalem was destroyed. When Jerusalem was destroyed in that generation, which is completely absurd, that is the sign. But again, you say, but it says they'll see him. And the idea is that they'll see the proof that it happened, not literally see him. They'll see a sign that he really is the Christ, the Son of God. Now, if that sounds like a stretch, turn over to Matthew 26. This is Jesus on trial before Caiaphas. And if you remember, they can't get a false witness to agree about the charges against Jesus. They've arrested him, but they can't make a crime stick. And so they ask Jesus. They want him to incriminate himself. Verse 63. Matthew 26, 63. "But Jesus remained silent. And the high priest said to him, 'I adjure you by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God.'" That's the issue. Tell us if you're the Christ. Tell us if you're the Son of God. Will you acknowledge that? And Jesus says, "Absolutely. I will 100% own that." Verse 64. "Jesus said to him, 'You have said so,'" which is a message of affirmation. "'But I tell you, from now on, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven.' And then the high priest tore his robes and he said, 'He has uttered blasphemy. What further witness do we need? You have heard his blasphemy. What's your judgment?' And they answered, 'He deserves death.' And they spit in his face. They struck him. Some slapped him, saying, 'Prophesy to us, you Christ. Who is it that struck you?'" You guys, what did Jesus do that sent him over the edge? What did he do? He claimed to be the one of Daniel 7. I'm that guy who's coming to the Ancient of Days to receive a kingdom and glory and honor on the clouds of heaven. And he says, you're going to see that. See the second coming? No. They won't see the second coming because it hasn't happened. It's been 2,000 years. There's no second coming for them to see. What are they going to see? Well, many of these people in just 37 years will see their beloved holy city torn down bit by bit, destroyed by the Roman army. That's what they're going to see. They're not going to see Jesus physically coming or going. They're going to see Jerusalem as the sign that Jesus is in fact reigning from heaven. Think about signs in the Bible, you guys. Signs usually occur after the event, not before. When do we get baptized? Baptism is a sign of what? Salvation. When does it happen? Before or after salvation? After. Circumcision in the Old Covenant. It's a sign. Is it given before or after the little one was in the covenant? It was after. You remember when Moses is arguing with God about going in to Egypt to bring the Israelites out. And God says, I'll give you a sign. Here's your sign. When you're standing back here in a couple of years with all of the people, that'll be your sign. That happened after. The signs always come after. Always after the event. The sign that Jesus had gone into heaven to the Ancient of Days is that this wild prophecy of Jerusalem being destroyed in one generation came true. The sign is not up in the sky. The sign points to what happened when Jesus went up into heaven. It was Jerusalem being destroyed. This is the only thing that accounts for all these realities, that Jesus is on the throne now, reigning in glory. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for these words, and they are hard. It is hard for us to wrap our mind around your words sometimes, but we do want to be faithful. We do know that Jesus is reigning, and for that we're thankful, and for that we're humbled. And we do pray that you would help us to understand your word, that you might be honored.